but I had no right to stop it. I often just stayed in meditation upstairs while my guests met downstairs. Thus the notion, a Sunday morning services at Mickey's, started in the spring of 1972, a tradition that has continued every Sunday for over 40 years. Meanwhile, summer was approaching, and it was time to begin preparing for my trip to California. I figured I would camp in my van at the spiritual community for 3 to 4 weeks and then come back home in time for classes. The drive out there took me about 10 days because I continued all my meditation sessions along the way. When I arrived at the community, I found a very rural setting with a large expanse of land and many small rustic cabins. The people seemed like back-to-the-earth type folks, and I fit right in. During registration, I noticed special name tags for guests who wanted to practice silence. I had no interest in meeting people or making new friends. That would just be a distraction to my inner work. So I decided to use the trip to step up my practices to an even stricter level. I would remain in total silence during my visit. There were no available campgrounds near the temple area, so I simply parked my van in the nearest dirt parking lot. That is where I would live for a few weeks. After getting situated, I began doing my afternoon yoga and meditation sessions in their temple. Though I was accustomed to being alone, I immediately realized that I would be fine here for a while. These people understood what I was into and would leave me to my practices. I continued fasting 3 times a week, and when I ate my salad, I always sat alone. I was not exactly the social type, but I did attend evening meditation and chanting programs in the temple. In fact, that was where I was first exposed to Easter chanting. Because I was in silence, I didn't chant, but I could feel the upliftment of the energy in the room. I would have gone on like that during my entire stay if it were not for a dream I had. I hardly ever dreamed, and when I did, the dreams didn't seem to have any deep significance. One night, I had a phenomenal lucid dream that had a very profound effect on me. I dreamed that I was doing intensely focused Zen walking. I was very consciously placing one foot in front of the other as I slowly headed toward the mouth of a cave. I entered the cave without incident and proceeded into the darkness that stretched before me. When it became very dark, I picked up a wooden torch mounted on the side of the cave. I lit it and continued as before. I noticed that the air was getting thinner and thinner the deeper I went into the cave. There was an almost frighteningly strong sense of purpose. I was going to explore deep into this unknown cave until I found what I was looking for. Nothing was going to stop me. I began to see a faint light far off in the distance. Not a single thought passed through my mind, yet I intuitively knew that was where I was going. As I approached, I could see that the light was coming from above and shining down into the cave. The closer I got to the source of the light, the thinner the air became. I could hardly breathe, but I kept on going. The experience was similar to what had been happening in my practices. In my meditations, the deeper I went, the more my breath was slowed down, until eventually it would naturally stop flowing. I don't know how long I would stay in that breathless state, but I would come back and gasp for air. At some point, my walk through this cave felt just like that stage of my meditations. I was almost there. I could see the streaming rays of light pouring onto the cave floor just in front of me. I felt as though I would collapse from the lack of oxygen, but I found the will to take that final step into the light. In an instant, I was completely bathed in a flood of blinding light. I turned upward to climb into the light, but my hands hit a metal grate on the roof of the cave. There was no way out from here. Not a thought entered my mind. Not a sigh left my lips. With the same steely sense of purpose that had led me into this cave, I turned and began to walk back out. There was simply the knowing I would have to find another way. Chapter 18, Letting Go of the Rope. I awoke from that dream a changed person. My way of thinking had been transformed at a very profound level. For the first time, I questioned whether more and more discipline was going to take me where I so desperately wanted to go. Sitting alone in my van that morning, I knew the answer was no. My path to true freedom was subtler than simply requiring a tighter grip. Something much wiser than me had reached into my psyche that night and rearranged my entire relationship with myself. I no longer saw the lower aspect of myself, with all its personal issues and melodramas, as the enemy that had to be destroyed. I looked at him now with a new understanding. I needed to use all these disturbed personal energies for my ascent. It was perfectly clear to me that since he was the problem, he was also the solution. I actually felt a tinge of compassion toward that struggling person within me. I would later come to learn that the Bhagavad Gita says that one should raise the self with self, not trample down the self. I had been trampling down my personal self in the name of getting free from his humanness. I now needed to learn how to raise those energies up to assist me on the journey. I left my van and walked in the direction of the temple building. I was feeling much lighter and more open. I felt like I wanted to unbind myself and spread my wings. But there was something I needed to do first. Since the beginning of my mental disciplines, I had imagined a room inside my head where I would take my personal self to meditate. It was a room with giant wooden doors for entry and solid glass for walls. What made this room so special was that the glass walls looked out upon the entire universe. Sitting in the lone meditation seat, one could see Earth suspended in the darkness of space. And in the distance were stars and galaxies floating in the infinite. Whenever Mickey had a problem, I took him there to chill out. I even used to play with leaving him there. I wanted him always to be quiet, and I wanted him always to remember that all his experiences were happening on a tiny speck of dirt floating through infinite space. That morning, when I stopped on my way to the temple, I closed my eyes and opened the giant wooden doors to that very special room. The person I had left sitting on the meditation seat immediately straightened himself up. As I approached him, he became more disciplined and focused. In drastic contrast to how strict I had been in the past, I reached my hand out to him in a kind and caring manner and said, "You can come out now." What followed that utterance makes me ashamed to this day for thinking this practice was some sort of an innocent mind game. The moment I said those words, I experienced an emotional release, the intensity of which I had never imagined possible. Tears poured from my eyes, and my legs completely buckled beneath me. My heart broke open as though some major event had taken place that allowed for a lifetime's worth of relief. Once this cathartic release had run its course, I realized something I will never forget. That scared, troubled person in there, whom I had been watching and judging, was indeed a person. The psyche is a person with feelings and thoughts, hopes, fears, and dreams. He is not to be locked in a room and constantly told to shut up. There are much more constructive ways to deal with these disturbed, self-centered energies. Unfortunately, I had to learn this the hard way, through experience. Feeling more whole than I had been feeling for a long while, I remembered my statement in the dream. I'll have to find another way. There was no question as to what the other way would be. I had to learn to surrender more, instead of struggling so much. I had already determined to surrender to life's flow, even if I couldn't understand where it was taking me. I had to do the same thing inwardly. I needed to learn to just relax inside, instead of fighting with my mind so much. Just because the voice talks doesn't mean I have to listen to it or let it affect the direction of my life. It has nothing to do with me. I can just relax regardless of what it's saying. I was back to the basics. I am the one who notices the voice talking. I came out of silence for the rest of my stay at the community. I don't mean I talked a lot, because I didn't. I was just social enough to where people felt comfortable talking to me. I met some of the longtime residents and listened to stories of their own journeys. Despite the changes I was going through, I didn't change my meditation and yoga sessions. They were not the problem. I was the problem. I had built a mental concept of absolute discipline that was actually holding me back. In my meditations, I'd been achieving heights by pushing down on the lower energies. But that was just a form of suppression. I had to learn to channel those energies upward instead of pushing them away from me. It took some time, but I eventually began to realize the true purpose of yoga. Done properly, yoga is the science of channeling all energies upward until they merge together at the highest point, oneness. After a few weeks at the community, I started my journey home. It was a wiser, clearer person who drove back to Florida. Though the seeds had been planted and some very deep lessons had been learned, it was going to take some time for me to learn how to come to peace with myself. Meanwhile, I was looking forward to returning home to my land and to the solitude of my beautiful house in the woods. Chapter 19. Acceptance, acceptance, and more acceptance. My mind remained very peaceful during my drive across the country, but I faced a serious challenge to my vow of acceptance the moment I arrived home. As I drove through the woods onto the interior field, instead of the characteristic silence, I heard the buzz of a circular saw. I then saw Sandy and my friend Bob Gould donned in carpentry aprons and climbing on a structure they were building on my land. It was one of those rub-your-eyes-in-disbelief moments. I asked what was going on. Sandy cheerfully informed me that she was building a house, and Bob Gould had agreed to help her. I don't recall the demeanor of my voice, but I reminded her that this was my land on which she was building her house. Again, very cheerfully, Sandy replied that she was laying no claim to the house, and it would be mine when she decided to leave. She obviously had worked it all out in her head and had no problem with it. I decided I better go home and meditate a bit before responding. Imagine what that voice in my head was saying. Oh my God, how dare she make a decision like that without even asking me? I don't want another house on my land. I don't want anyone else staying out here, so why would I want another house? How in the world does someone make a decision to build a house on someone else's property without even asking them? On and on it went, but by then I was very well trained in just calmly observing all these thoughts being created by the preference-driven mind. After all, if I had wanted another house on my property, that voice would be saying, "What a miracle! God stepped in and started building me a second house without my having to do a single thing." To me, it didn't matter what that voice was saying. I knew to the core of my being that I was not going to give him the time of day, not to mention the run of my life. If I had a choice between using this real-life situation to get my way or to free myself from being bound to my way, I would choose freedom every time. That was the essence of my experiment with life. If it's down to a matter of preference, life wins. So I went back up the hill, strapped on an apron, and helped them build Sandy's house. It felt good to be building again. This time around, I was not a greenhorn. I was a carpenter. The difference is amazing between the first time you do something and the next. I felt like I knew what I was doing, and that gave me a sense of confidence and inner strength. I wasn't working on the house for Sandy or for myself. The flow of life had placed me in this situation. It was during the building of Sandy's cabin that I first started the ritual of offering my work up to the invisible force that was guiding me. I was not in charge, yet life continued to unfold as if it knew just what it was doing. I would serve that force. Call it what you want. God, Christ, Spirit. These were no longer just names of something to believe in. The events that were pulling me through life were tangible and real to me. Inwardly, I began to offer everything I did up to the universal force. All I wanted was to return home to that beautiful place deep inside of me. If following the invisible hand of life would take me there, so be it. Sandy's house was very simple. It was similar to what I thought we were going to build for my place. Her 12-by-16-foot cabin had no electricity, no plumbing, and no inside siding. and the window openings were covered with only screens and some plastic. It only took about 6 weeks to build and cost almost nothing, but she loved it. I smile now when I look back at my initial resistance. I could never have imagined how many important life experiences of mine would end up being tied to that cabin. Meanwhile, summer was over, and the time to start my classes at Santa Fe was rapidly approaching. I had been true to my commitment of not allowing a single thought to enter my mind about what I was going to teach. How would I ever know what life was capable of doing if I was always in control? I walked into my first class at Santa Fe, completely open to whatever would unfold. As the students filed in, I simply quieted my mind and asked myself, "Do you have something worthwhile to teach these students?" In my heart, I knew that I had a wealth of knowledge that would be both interesting and beneficial to their lives. So I took a breath, stood up, and just started speaking. I couldn't have known it at the time, but that exact moment was laying the groundwork for the next phase of my spiritual journey, becoming a teacher. The words just flowed out. There was no prior thinking involved. The first session laid out the roadmap of what we were going to do in the class, just as though a curriculum had been decided beforehand. It was similar to when I was writing that economics paper in my van in the woods, except this time I was watching a continuous stream of inspiration turning into a powerful lecture. I was not doing any of this. I was just aware of it. As the semester progressed, this kept happening class after class. I was amazed by what was being taught in these classes. It was as though all the knowledge from my schooling, plus all that I had learned through introspective meditation and the relentless watching of the voice, was being woven into a cohesive whole. The premise of the course was centered on the possibility that one underlying truth exists in the universe, and all of man's knowledge was just looking at this truth from different perspectives. The exploration of that premise would involve physics, biology, psychology, and religion. What was the possibility that they were all saying the same thing? I'd never thought about things in this way before. In fact, I'd spent my time learning not to make thoughts a pastime. How could each class come out so perfectly without my doing it? Nonetheless, the presentation was unfolding on a class-by-class basis before my eyes. The success of the classes was overwhelming. I would start the semester with 20 students in the room, and by the end, the count had doubled. I remember one class where I literally had trouble entering the classroom. 20 students were registered, and another 40 or so were either sitting in the class or listening from the hallway. People would just keep bringing their friends. I was still into being quiet and didn't want all this to become a distraction to my practices. So I tried to isolate myself by coming to school just before class, leaving right afterward, and not attending any faculty meetings or school functions. It didn't matter. This was the 70s, and I was teaching universal thought in the midst of the consciousness revolution. Over time, students and their friends began to show up for Sunday meditations at my place. As if that were not enough, those classes at Santa Fe laid the groundwork for another very spiritual flow of events. This time it was regarding, of all things, my doctoral dissertation. I've been telling Dr. Goffman that my life had taken me far from the field of economics, and I had no intention of writing a dissertation. Nonetheless, one day he made me promise, as a personal favor to him, that I would turn in something, anything, for him to read. I had great love and respect for Dr. Goffman, and I saw it as an act of surrender to acquiesce to his wishes. That very night, I sat down on the floor of my house, lit my kerosene lamp, and asked myself if I had something to write that was worth such an enormous undertaking. It only took a moment to realize that I did have something very important to write, and I would love for Dr. Goffman to read it. It seems that life had just given me the perfect opportunity to write about that voice in your head and the oneness behind all of science and religion, just as I had been teaching in my classes at Santa Fe. With that as a topic, I was filled with inspiration. Though I knew it wouldn't be accepted as an economics dissertation, I put my heart and soul into my writing. As it turned out, the finished document had an unexpected destiny of its own. A professor on my doctoral committee had a publisher contact me, and within a year, my dissertation was published under the title, The Search for Truth. 35 years later, that book still sells copies every month on Amazon, a fitting tribute to the acts of surrender that brought it into this world. What is important from all of this is that if I had listened to my own mind, none of this would have happened. By following the flow of life instead of my own preferences, I was now a carpenter, a teacher, and a published author. Inwardly, I had grown as well. The sharp line I had drawn between spiritual and non-spiritual had begun to fade. The energy I experienced while teaching my classes at Santa Fe was the same energy I was dealing with in my yoga and meditations. In meditation, that energy would flow upward and lift me away from my everyday self. When I stood in front of a class, the very same energy would explode into a passionate, heartfelt lecture. Not only did I begin to see all this as the flow of spiritual energy, but I also began to see that there was no difference between coming to class to teach and driving home to do my meditative practices. I was teaching those classes because an amazing flow of events had put me there. I was driving home because an amazing flow of events had put me there. Neither of these destinations was decided by me. They were the result of my letting go of myself. Little by little, the fabric of my life was composed of the results of my surrender. I was becoming surrounded by a life that had been built for me, not by me. In my wildest dreams, however, I could never have imagined where this was going to lead me. Chapter 20, The Most Important Thing I Was Ever Asked to Do. The summer of 1973 ushered in some very interesting changes where I lived. Through no effort of my own, many of the five-acre lots around my property were being purchased by folks drawn to a back-to-nature lifestyle. Unsurprisingly, many of these people were into some form of meditation and yoga. I was still holding on to my self-concept of a meditator wanting solitude in the woods, so I had little interaction with my new neighbors. I must admit, however, that my afternoon walks became more interesting as various rough-sawn cabins began to spring up in the woods around me. A man named Bob Tilchin purchased the property directly behind my house. I had not known him before, but he was into yoga and Sufism and was a very gentle soul. He hired my friend Bob Gould to help him build his house, so it all felt like family. One day Bob Tilchin came to me and asked me to do him a favor. He was pen pals with an inmate named Jerry at Union Correctional Institution, UCI, a maximum security prison about 40 miles north of Gainesville. Bob had promised to visit this inmate once in a while, but now had to go out of town. He asked me if I would visit Jerry while he was gone. This was a very strange request for me. I had no prior experience in this area, and I was still very protective of my attempts to live a solitary life. As the voice of my thoughts said no, the voice of my lips said yes. I had no idea what it would be like to go into a maximum security prison to meet a total stranger, but I was about to find out. I drove up to the prison one Saturday morning and met Jerry, a young black man, in the designated visiting area. We spent a few hours together discussing topics similar to what I had been teaching in my classes. He seemed genuinely interested, and he was a very intelligent young man. He had been doing meditation for some time, so we spent a while meditating together. Jerry expressed his appreciation for the visit and asked me to come back. I had noticed that other than Bob Tilchin and me, no one else was on Jerry's approved visitors list. Our meditation together had been amazingly deep, and I felt overwhelmed by peace when I left the prison. Somehow, being in that setting had touched something very deep within me. Before I was even out of the gate, I was looking forward to coming back. When I returned to see Jerry for the second time, he had a surprise for me. He had so enjoyed our visit and our meditation together that he had created a list of 5 or 6 other inmates who wanted to meet for group meditation. I contacted the authorities and found out that such a group meeting would only be possible as a religious service. Jerry considered himself a Buddhist, and I had done Zen Buddhist meditation, so I started what probably was the first Buddhist group in the history of a North Florida prison. We met in the chapel every other Saturday morning, and the whole scene was quite surreal for someone with my background. When I arrived at the prison, I would pass through the main gate that was surrounded by double coils of razor wire. I would then pass through 2 more gates before I was searched and patted down. Shortly thereafter, a call would come across the loudspeakers in the various cell blocks. Buddhist. From a very quiet place deep inside myself, I watched that voice in my head say, "How in the world did I get here?" The group grew over the years, and when Jerry was transferred to Florida State Prison, I also did a group there. It may have been acts of surrender that originally put me into those prison groups, but once I was there, it was my heart and soul. Whenever I would go into the prisons, I would feel a powerful increase in the spiritual energy flow within me. And my meditations were much deeper when I sat with the inmates than when I sat for hours at home by myself. I didn't understand what was happening, but I looked forward to every visit as an experience of spiritual upliftment. I ran the groups pretty much like the classes at Santa Fe. I did not plan any sessions. I just let the energy give the talks. The men were able to relate immediately to the notion of the talkative voice in their head. They were very receptive to learning how to quiet that voice and deal with the inner patterns of anger, fear, and strong drives. The inmates' deep-seated sincerity about their spiritual growth made those prison groups one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. A single request from my neighbor Bob Tilchin, to which I had initial resistance, grew into more than 30 years of working with the incarcerated. The men in my group became part of my extended family, and they continue to live in a place deep in my heart. It was the summer of 1973, and in the most unlikely of places, my heart center was learning to open. I was being taught how to serve. This is not something I would have come up with my own. My whole being thought my path to self-realization was about meditation. Fortunately, life knew better, and she was starting to guide me away from myself through service to others. Section 3. From Solitude to Service. Chapter 21. The Call of a Living Master. Summers are brutal in Florida, even in the woods. My house had no air conditioning, and with a solid wall of glass facing west, it did not exactly have passive solar design. I still had a few months left before my class at Santa Fe started again in mid-September, so I took a drive back out to Northern California for a visit. Before returning home, I got wind that Shelley, my ex-wife, was living at some sort of a yoga center in the San Francisco area. I managed to get the number and gave her a call. I had not seen her for years, and it fascinated me that I had gotten so deeply into yoga, and evidently so had she. I drove down to Piedmont and found where Shelley was staying. It was great to see her again, and my heart felt very open. She began to show me around the beautiful house that served as a meditation center for a small number of residents. We went upstairs to see the meditation room, and once again, life caught me completely by surprise. Scattered around the room were photographs of a yoga master they called Baba. I had never heard of him, but there was no reason I would have. I had been living in the woods of North Central Florida for a few years by then, and he lived in India. The pictures of that holy man were mesmerizing. I could not take my eyes off of them. The energy flow inside of me welled up to the point between my eyebrows, and a tremendous peace came over my whole being. I asked if I could meditate there for a while. Shelley nodded and went about her business. I meditated in that room for hours, with shimmering energy coursing throughout my body. The whole room seemed to be filled with energy. Something was going on that I didn't understand. I only knew that I was being drawn into deep meditation without my normal struggle. I stayed in the room for a very long time, and when I finally came out, it was time to bid Shelley goodbye. That was certainly not the visit I had imagined. What had started out as a very personal trip, life had managed to turn into a powerful spiritual experience. If that had been all that transpired from the visit, it would have been fantastic, but it was only just the beginning. I returned home in early September to find someone I didn't know staying at Sandy's house. Evidently, Sandy had gone on a trip and allowed a friend, Rama Malone, to stay at her place. Rama was very outgoing and vivacious. She was filled with excitement and immediately drew me into her world. The first time I went up to meet her, she invited me into the cabin to show me what she had done with the place. Very enthusiastically, she beckoned me up to the loft. I climbed the rough sawn ladder, and when my head cleared the opening, what I saw almost knocked me back downstairs. The entire loft area was covered with pictures of the same yoga master I had just encountered at Shelley's place. Now, I believe in coincidences, but this was twice in a row on opposite sides of the continent. In 1973, there simply were not that many people in America who knew of this holy man from India. It felt like he was following me. Rama immediately started telling me that Baba Muktananda was planning to come to America next year in spring, and I should invite him to Gainesville. At first, I thought we were having a fanciful conversation, until I realized that she was dead serious. I took a deep breath and tried to reason with her. I reminded her that I lived alone in the woods, and I had gone out of my way for years to not attract people. How could I be in a position to write to India and invite a highly respected yoga master to a small town in North Central Florida? There was no reasoning with her. She insisted that I write a letter to India on Santa Fe Community College letterhead and invite Baba to stop in Gainesville on his way from Atlanta to Miami. I thought it was a crazy idea. My mind kept telling me that there was no way Baba would ever come here. I actually felt embarrassed to write the letter and send it off to India. But what choice did I have? I could either listen to my resistant mind or recognize that life had brought me in contact with this great yogi, given me a deep experience sitting before his picture, and then stuck an impassioned devotee onto my own land to force me to invite him to Gainesville. Ultimately, I surrendered and mailed the letter. Some months later, I received a response telling me that someone would come to my place to discuss the possibility of a Gainesville visit. When he arrived out here, I was surprised to be meeting a very professionally dressed young man. Apparently, he was just as surprised to be meeting a hippie-type character living alone in the woods. You could tell that he wasn't all that impressed. He began to explain to me what it would take to host a week-long visit from Baba and his entourage. They would need facilities for his staff of up to 20 people, a room large enough for 50 to 100 people for daily sessions during the week, and a weekend retreat site that could house up to a few hundred people. He was very skeptical about my ability to arrange everything, and who could blame him? I was a part-time teacher at a community college, earning $350 a month, not exactly the credentials they were looking for. In the end, he told me I was welcome to see what I could arrange, and they would get back to me. It certainly didn't sound promising, but at least I didn't get a definitive no. Before he left, I asked him an important question. If his group was trying to get people interested in Baba, how exactly did they promote him on his world tour? I didn't think an Indian saint who spoke no English would attract that many people. All he told me was that Baba was a very powerful Siddha master, and people would want to meet him. I didn't understand what that meant, but I figured I'd find out later. A few months went by, and we were given a tentative date for when Baba might pass through Gainesville, January 18th, 1975. The excitement about a possible visit by a world-renowned yoga master only serve to accelerate the energy around my classes and the Sunday services. Each week, things grew until I was forced to build a small addition onto my house to fit more people. With the publication of my book, The Search for Truth, in the spring of 1974, the energy was fanned even more. Rama and Sandy had both come and gone by the spring of that year, and Sandy's house sat empty until a young woman named Donna Wagner moved in. Donna was finishing her degree at the university when she started sitting in on my Santa Fe classes. Though just a few years older than the other students, Donna was more centered and mature. She had a very deep understanding of what I was teaching, and she came to most of my classes and all the Sunday services. For about a year before she moved in, it seemed like time and again we kept bumping into each other in town. These chance meetings happened so often that I began to wonder what was going on. Donna started to help organize the Sunday services after Sandy left. She would often stay in Sandy's house on Saturday nights to help set up for and greet the people on Sunday mornings. Eventually, she just stopped going home. If I had known then that she was moving out of a nice condominium her parents had purchased for her and into this tiny cabin in the woods with no plumbing or electricity, I might not have been so quick to let her move in. If I had known then that we were destined to fall in love, get married, and have a beautiful daughter together, given my mindset at the time, I definitely would not have let her move in. It would take a few more years of learning to surrender before I would be capable of dropping my spiritual self-concept enough to accept the special relationships that life had in store for me. Chapter 22, Shaktipat. We had so many things to take care of if we were going to host a visit from Baba. None of us had done anything like this before, so we had to learn things as we went along. First, we found a summer camp in the Ocala National Forest that could easily handle a large weekend retreat during its off-season. Next, we put the word out that we needed a very large house for Baba's 20-person staff and the weekday meditation sessions. As a college town, Gainesville is not known for its large mansions, but someone contacted me and offered us the perfect house for the entire month of January. Things were definitely falling into place. The weekend retreat was going to be the clincher. If we couldn't get enough people signed up, Baba would never come. Don and I had to make hundreds of individual phone calls and send mailings all over the state to attract enough people. It took real surrender for me to hook up a phone at my house and use that as the contact number on all flyers and phone messages. We were passionate about getting the word out, and we had a tremendous response from all over the state. For years, I had thought that a spiritual life was about spending every day in silence and solitude. I was now running around getting all this work done. Yet somehow, I felt more open and more connected to the energy flow than ever before. I kept my morning and evening meditations, but the hours in between were devoted to my classes and bringing Baba to Gainesville. I had surrendered just enough to where the flow of life was no longer something I chose to give into. The flow had taken over my life. It had gone from subtly guiding me to running me. My mind kept telling me that after this was over, I would go back to my solitary lifestyle. As usual, my mind was wrong. Before Baba came to Gainesville, we received an invitation to attend his December retreat just outside of Atlanta. I was anxious to meet him, plus it seemed like a good idea to know what to expect when he came to Gainesville the next month. About six of us packed into my van, and we made the trip north. When we arrived at the retreat site, we were ushered into a large hall with 50 to 60 other people. So began four of the most intense days of my life. I remember the first meditation session with Baba. We were told he would walk around among us while we were meditating. It was so dark in the room that I couldn't see a thing, yet at some point I felt a strong presence behind me. It got stronger and stronger until I realized that Baba was standing right beside me. He touched the point between my eyebrows, exactly where I always felt the energy flow. He then moved on. We had two of these meditation sessions each day. Each time, I could definitely feel strong energy as Baba walked around behind me, but that was about it. It was hard to sit in that room all day. I would try to meditate just to get some privacy, but I was unable to get inside myself. Instead of my meditations getting deeper, I was locked out altogether. That was pretty much how I felt all the time, closed down. I was too spacey to think, my body hurt, and that voice in my head was driving me crazy. I was determined to sit it out, but I couldn't wait until it was over. It went on like this until the final day, and I was very confused, to say the least. On that final morning, I decided perhaps I wasn't being open enough in how I was relating to Baba. I had come to pay my respects to a great spiritual teacher, but he wasn't my teacher. Yogananda was my teacher. I decided that for this last day, I would even let go of that concept and just surrender completely to the experience in front of me. While the program was going on at the front of the hall, I sat in my seat and started to do Baba's mantra. I repeated Om Namah Shivaya over and over again. Before I knew it, I was very deep in meditation. All outer sounds had ceased, as had my mental chatter. I was in a place I had never been before, deep inside my heart. I felt like my heart was a giant cave that was protecting me and loving me. I was completely entranced and at peace. It soon became time for the evening meditation session, where Baba walked around tapping people. I found myself being pulled back into that very quiet place within my heart. While I was meditating, I felt Baba walk up behind me. The power emanating from him was very strong. Even though my eyes were closed and I was facing forward, I could feel the energy of his hand reaching out toward my head. The moment the palm of his hand reached above the crown of my head, what felt like 10,000 volts of electricity jumped from the base of my spine to meet his hand. It happened as fast as a bolt of lightning. In an instant, I was no longer in my body. Me, the one who lives in here, the one who looks out through the eyes and hears through the ears, the center of conscious awareness that notices the thoughts and emotions. I was no longer sitting inside doing those things. I was in a state of absolute panic, trying to hold on with all my might to my connection with the body. The upward rush of that much energy had dislodged me from where I normally sat within myself. I was experiencing tornado-forced winds trying to blow me out of my body, and I was struggling to hold on for dear life. No matter how hard I tried, I could not pull myself back into the body. It was one of those survival moments when pure fear opens you up to superhuman strength. It didn't matter. I could not even begin to pull against that force. I have no idea how long the experience lasted, but when Baba felt I'd had enough, he simply rubbed his hand across my back. The moment his hand physically touched my mid-back, everything stopped. I immediately fell back into my body and began to get somewhat oriented. The first thing I noticed was my heart. It wasn't beating. It was fluttering like the wings of a hummingbird. My first thought was, this is not good. Hearts don't last very long like this. The moment that thought formed in my mind, Baba reached in front of me and rubbed his hand over my heart. Instantly, my heart began beating normally. I was stunned by the experience and the power of this man. Who was he? How could he possibly have such control over my energy and my metabolic functions? I felt so humble to be in his presence. I have never felt so completely unburdened in my life. What had I been doing? Fasting, meditating, and struggling with myself for so many years? With a single touch, this man could bring about such transformation. At that moment, I understood what was meant by a Siddha master. Baba did not belong in this world. He was from somewhere else altogether. Chapter 23. Gainesville Hosts a Guru. We were invited to accompany Baba's group back to where they were staying in Atlanta. As I drove from the retreat, I contemplated what had happened the previous day. One of Baba's people told me that the experience was called Shaktipat, a special blessing by a Siddha master in which a very powerful spiritual energy is awakened within. When we arrived at the mansion in Atlanta where Baba was staying, his staff just assumed that I would now see Baba as my teacher. They told me that it was common that one would be drawn to a living master. What did I know? All this was way out of my league. I went outside to be alone. There was no question about what had happened the previous day or about the flow of events that had brought it all together. I remembered my commitment to surrender to life's flow, even if I didn't understand what was happening. I walked down the hill to the garage area where there were no people. I was very confused, but prepared to thank Yogananda for his guidance. I closed my eyes to go into the quiet place within where I had always felt a connection to him. I inwardly looked upward as if to say thank you, and suddenly the whole space above me opened into a limitless expanse. I felt as if a veil had been lifted from between my consciousness and that which was beyond me. I immediately felt oneness with all that I had been looking for. It was the most powerful and revealing experience I ever had. It only lasted a few moments, but I came back with an echo in my being saying, "Just exactly who do you think you're saying goodbye to?" I felt Yogananda's presence all around me and permeating me from within. From that moment forward, I never questioned my connection to him. When I rejoined Donna and my friends at the main house, they were making preparations to return home. As we headed back to Gainesville, we were all inspired about hosting Baba in just a few days. When he finally arrived, I couldn't believe how much attention he drew. Every place we went, it was standing room only. And though Baba was not a young man when he came through Gainesville, every day and night he would give lectures wherever people would invite him. I was doing my prison work at the time, and his staff told me that Baba would definitely want to go into the prison. We got it set up, and one afternoon we accompanied Baba into the maximum security facility. The inmates loved him, and when Baba left, he instructed his staff to continue visiting prisons. To this day, they trace all their worldwide prison work back to Baba's visit to Union Correctional Institution outside of Gainesville. The weekend retreat ended up being the largest retreat up to that point on Baba's world tour. I drove down to the camp a few days early to see if Baba's staff needed anything. While I was there, I noticed a dormitory building that had a VIP sign on the front door. Apparently, these were private rooms assigned to special guests. One of the names posted on a door caught my attention: R. Friedland. Shelley's maiden name was Friedland, and her brother's name was Ronnie. My mind said, "No way," and I just kept walking. I was stunned to see Ronnie at the retreat. We had not seen each other for years. It didn't matter. We were like brothers. How could we possibly have gone our separate ways and ended up the same place? We were so different. I was living the simple life in Gainesville, and he was a big-time attorney in Chicago. I prided myself in having no belongings, and he had a Ferrari, a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, and a private plane. Ronnie lived in a top-floor penthouse at Chicago's famous Twin Towers Marina, and he decorated the circular walls of his living room with pictures of Napoleon. What in the world was he doing here at this spiritual retreat, hanging out with a holy man from India? Shelley had introduced Ronnie to Baba, and apparently it was love at first sight. I spent a lot of time with Ronnie at the retreat, and he even invited me to accompany him when he took Baba and a few of his staff to Disney World. It was obvious that Ronnie had something very special going with Baba. I found out just how special when a few months later I received my first mailing from the new organization Baba formed in America. It was signed by the foundation's first president, Ron Friedland. My thoughts drifted back to that first awakening I'd had while sitting on that couch with Ronnie years earlier. My life had completely changed. Apparently, so at his. Chapter 24, The Temple is Built. I wish I could say that things went back to normal after Baba left, but they didn't. In fact, it wasn't until he left that I began to see the real effect that meeting him had on my life. Baba was like a wind that blew into town and permanently changed the direction of my life from one of solitude to one of service. And that was a good thing, because Gainesville's spiritual community had become invigorated. 40 to 50 people were coming out to my place for Sunday services, half of which had to sit outside on my decks. Plus, more and more people were sitting in on my classes at Santa Fe, especially once my second book, 3 Essays in Universal Law, was published. My answering machine was getting calls from all over the state, praising the retreat, and asking when the next one would be. This was a timely question, since at the retreat I was approached by a university professor who wanted us to host a retreat for his teacher, Ma Yogashakti, a lady saint from India known as Mataji. The number of tasks life was giving me was out of control, but I was surrendering to it. My morning and evening meditations were my refuge. Throughout the day, I took every opportunity to quiet myself and center within. Every time I got into and out of my car, I would slow down my breath and visualize Earth spinning through outer space. Before opening a door, any door, I would remember that I was walking through a door on this tiny planet in the vast emptiness of space. Fortunately, the energy flowing up to the point between my eyebrows helped me keep the focus of my attention there. I slowly began to realize that this life of constant service was the other way, referred to in the dream I had. On my new path to awakening, life was no longer an obstacle to my growth. Life was now the battlefield in which I was to remain conscious enough to willingly permit my old self to be stripped away. But let it be clear, I still had plenty of resistance left in me that had to be overcome. I kept getting pushed in the direction of hosting a retreat for Mataji. I had never heard of her, and I really did not want to do it. But I surrendered, and once again, life had something unexpected in store for me. A few days prior to the retreat, Mataji and I were taking a walk on my land when she suddenly stopped and looked into the woods. She stood there motionless for a few moments and then said in a quiet voice, "Mickey, this is a very holy piece of land. Someday there will be a great temple here, and many people will come." I clearly remember the voice in my head saying, over my dead body, "Yet within 6 months, a temple would be sitting in that exact spot in the woods." It was as though Mataji had been sent here to begin the process of turning my place of solitude into a spiritual center. More than once at the retreat, she mentioned that there was going to be a great temple on Mickey's land. I cringed every time she said it. The following Sunday after services, someone announced that if we wanted to build a temple, we needed to start raising some money. A few people made small donations, and others offered me their labor and some materials. I really didn't want another building on my land, but it seemed everyone else did. Fortunately, by now I had become pretty experienced at ignoring what I wanted, and instead following the flow of life. That same Sunday, I walked down to my house, took out a piece of paper, and began designing the new temple. In just a few hours, I had a floor plan and a rough elevation of the building. I wanted to make the roof of the temple the main design feature, so I met with my friend, Bob Gould, and we decided to give the temple a butterfly roof. A butterfly roof challenges conventional roof design because it's low in the middle and slopes up on both sides. From the inside, the temple's exposed beam ceiling would be a unique and dynamic structure that looked like giant wings opening up to the sky. I designed the temple to allow about 3 times the seating area afforded by my house. The very next day, I found the best spot on the land to locate the building and began clearing the site. It was, of course, exactly where Mataji had been staring when she pronounced that a great temple would be built. I had estimated that materials for the temple would cost about $8,000. Labor was not a problem. We would just do all the work ourselves. But the people who came out to my place on Sundays didn't exactly have deep pockets. I had no idea where the money would come from. The money just kept showing up the moment we needed it. Sometimes I didn't even know where it came from. The closest we came to being stopped was on a day when only one or two boards were left in the material pile. My co-workers were ribbing me that it had finally happened. We were out of materials, and I would have to send them home. I told them that as long as there was a single board left, we were not done. We broke for lunch, and I went out to check the mail. Sitting in my mailbox was an envelope with $2,000 in cash. There was no name, and to this day I have no idea who put that money there. Things like that just kept happening again and again. The amazing part was not just that the money kept showing up exactly when we needed it. It kept showing up in exactly the amounts we needed to go to the next step. That is how the temple got built. It took about 3 months, then suddenly one day it was done. In September 1975, we held our first Sunday services in the new temple. People brought gifts of spiritual items that had meaning to them. A professor of religion brought a beautiful wood statuette of the Buddha. Another person brought a picture of Jesus for the altar, and I went down to my house and got my favorite picture of Yogananda, which had been sitting on my meditation space since I moved in. Little by little, the items in the temple began to represent all religions, all saints, and all masters. As its roof rafters stretched up toward the sky, the temple also belonged to those whose religion was the reality of the infinite. This temple sat on the planet Earth, a tiny ball spinning through the vast darkness of empty space. It spun around one star, of which there were billions in our galaxy alone. This temple was universal in its embrace of all religions, and it was universal in its embrace of the universe itself. Thus it came to be called Temple of the Universe. Chapter 25, Opening the Heart Chakra. There was no putting the genie back in the bottle. Between the retreats, my books, my classes, and the temple, we were on the map for people into yoga and the New Age movement. Running retreats for visiting spiritual teachers must have been what we were supposed to be doing, because I kept getting requests, one after the other. Before the temple was even complete, I had accepted responsibility for sponsoring another retreat for a spiritual teacher I had never heard of. As fate would have it, this teacher would end up being an important part of my life for years to come. Amrit Desai was different from our other Indian visitors. He had lived in America for many years and had a large spiritual community up north. When he arrived at the temple, I was surprised by how many people he attracted. The first night's gathering completely filled the temple. After the program, which was very powerful, I found myself intrigued by Amrit's energy. I wanted to understand how so much energy could emanate from a person, especially since Amrit never even touched anyone. I then got pretty brazen. I figured he was a guest in our house, and a proper host would make sure that his guest was taken care of. I took a deep breath and walked into the guest room where Amrit had gone. He seemed to be meditating, so I quietly walked over and sat down next to him. The moment I sat down, it was as though I could feel a semblance of what he was feeling. The energy flow inside of me increased significantly, and I felt as though I had been dropped into an ocean of love. It was a deeply spiritual experience. We sat quietly for a while, and then he turned toward me and said, "I never do this anymore." He placed his right hand over my forehead, and I immediately felt a gentle flow of warm energy passing into my body. The flow was overwhelmingly powerful, and I became completely transfixed by the beauty of the experience. I could feel the energy building up within me and rising toward my heart. It filled my heart fuller and fuller until it burst open. I've never felt so much love in my entire life. I was completely overcome by the flow of energy starting from his hand, coursing through me, and then pouring out of the burst-open, hard area. By the time Amrit removed his hand from my forehead, I was so filled with energy that I couldn't move. When I finally tried to stand up,